is an honor to be here today at this esteemed institution. And before going on, I would like to acknowledge the presence this afternoon of two special guests, a Nobel laureate and Secretary of Energy, Dr. Stephen Chu, and the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and former Commander of Strategic Command, General James Cartwright. To the NDU community, thank you for all you do in service to our country. And to the students in particular, I wish you the best as you prepare to take on important leadership positions. I know you're really here to listen to what the Vice President has to say, so I'll be very brief. The topic of the Vice President's address, the role and future of nuclear weapons, is one that is absolutely critical to America's national security and strategic strength. President Obama has helped focus our attention on the challenges of reducing nuclear dangers and taking concrete steps toward the ultimate goal of eliminating nuclear weapons. At the same time, as he and the Vice President have said, as long as nuclear weapons are required to deter aggression and defend our country and our allies, we will maintain a safe, secure, and effective nuclear arsenal. Before becoming Vice President, Mr. Biden served for 36 years in the United States Senate, representing the state of Delaware. During his time in the Senate, he served as chairman of the Judiciary and Foreign Relations Committees. Over his career, he established a reputation as being one of America's foremost experts on international affairs. As Vice President, he has provided exemplary leadership on issues relating to proliferation, deterrence, and the state of our nuclear enterprise. We are honored that he has come to NDU to share his thoughts on such an important topic. It is my personal honor and pleasure to introduce the Vice President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden, Jr.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. It's an honor to be here, and it's an honor to be introduced by Bob Gates. Ladies and gentlemen, Secretaries Gates and Chu, General Cartwright, Undersecretary Toucher, Administrator D'Agostino, and Vice Admiral Rondo, members of the Armed Services, students, thank you all for coming. Quite frankly, this speech was a collaborative document. Bob Gates could deliver this speech, General Cartwright could deliver this speech, probably do it better than I will. But the fact of the matter is that at its founding, former Secretary of War gave this campus a mission that is the very essence of our national defense. He said, and I quote, "not to promote war, but preserve peace by intelligent and adequate preparation to repel aggression." That's what this is all about. That's what I think this speech is about, quite frankly. For more than a century, you and your predecessors have heeded that call. There are fewer contributions that would be greater that any citizen could make than to aspire to meet the goal of this university. Many statesmen have walked to this campus and pronounced statesmen better than I have. I told you Bob could give this speech better. But many statesmen have walked this campus, including our own administration's outstanding national security advisor, General Jim Jones. You taught him well. Folks, George Kennan, the scholar and diplomat, lectured here at the National War College in the late 40s. And just back from Moscow then, in a small office not very far from here, he developed the doctrine of containment that guided a generation of Cold War foreign policy. And some of the issues that arose during that time seem like very distant memories now. As a matter of fact, I see some old colleagues from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee days when I got there 180 years ago as a 29-year-old kid, and some of them seem very distant. But the topic I came to discuss with you today, the challenge posed by nuclear weapons, continues to demand our urgent attention, just as it did immediately after the war. Last April in Prague, the President laid out his vision for protecting our country from nuclear threats. He made clear that we will take concrete steps toward a world without nuclear weapons. while retaining a safe, secure, and effective arsenal as long as we still need it. We will work to strengthen our nuclear nonproliferation treaty. We'll also do everything in our power to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons to terrorists and also to states that don't already possess them. You know, it's very easy to recognize the threat posed by nuclear terrorism, but we must not underestimate how proliferation to a state could be destabilizing in an entire region, regions critical to us, to our security, and may very well prompt the neighbors in that region to feel that they have to garner nuclear weapons themselves. Our agenda is based on a clear-eyed assessment of our national interest. We've long relied upon nuclear weapons to deter potential adversaries. But now, as our technology improves, we are developing non-nuclear ways to accomplish the same objectives. The Quadrennial Defense Review and the Ballistic Missile Defense Review, which Secretary Gates released 2 weeks ago, presented a plan to further strengthen our preeminent conventional forces so that they can defend our nation and our allies well into the future. Capabilities like an adaptive missile defense shield, conventional warheads with worldwide reach, and others that are developing and being developed will enable us to reduce the role of nuclear weapons as other nuclear powers begin to draw down even further, just as we wish to do. With these modern capabilities, even with deep nuclear reductions, we will remain undeniably strong and in a position to defend our interest against all our enemies. As we've said many times, the spread of nuclear weapons is the greatest threat facing the country and, I would argue, facing humanity. And that is why we're working both to stop their proliferation and eventually to eliminate them. But until that day comes, we have to do everything in our power to maintain our arsenal and make sure it's reliable. At the vanguard of this effort, alongside our military, are our nuclear weapons laboratories, true national treasures that deserve our full support. Their invaluable contributions range from building the world's fastest supercomputers to developing cleaner fuels to surveying the heavens with robotic telescopes. But the labs are best known. They're best known for the work they do to secure our country. Time and again, we've asked our labs to meet our most urgent strategic needs. And time and again, they've delivered. In 1939, as fascism began its march across Europe, Asia, and Africa, Albert Einstein warned President Roosevelt that the Nazis were racing to build a weapon, the likes of which the world had never seen. In the Southwest desert, under the leadership of Robert Oppenheimer, the physicist of Los Alamos won that race and literally changed the course of history. Sandia was born near Albuquerque soon after the Second World War and became our premier facility for developing the non-nuclear components of our nuclear weapons arsenal. And a few years later, the institution that became Lawrence Livermore took root in California. During the arms race that followed the Korean War, it designed and developed warheads to keep our nuclear capabilities second to none. These examples and many other I could name illustrate that everyone in this room knows, but many in our country do not know, that the past century's defining conflicts were decided not just in the battlefield, but in the classrooms and laboratory. As Air Force General Hap Arnold, an aviation pioneer whose vision helped shape the National War College, once argued, he said that the First World War was decided by brawn, the Second World War by logistics. The Third World War would be different, he predicted. It will be won by brains. Well, General Arnold got it almost right. Great minds like Kennan and Oppenheimer helped win the Cold War and prevent a Third World War altogether. During the Cold War, we tested nuclear weapons in our atmosphere, underwater and underground, to confirm that they worked before deploying them and to evaluate more advanced concepts as well. but explosive testing damaged our health, disrupted our environment, and set back our non-proliferation agenda. 18 years ago, George H.W. Bush, President Bush, signed the nuclear testing moratorium enacted by Congress, which is in place to this very day. Under that moratorium, our laboratories have maintained our arsenals through what is known, you all know, but the public doesn't know the phrase, our stockpile stewardship program. They're able to do that without underground testing, using techniques that are as successful as they are cutting edge. Today, the directors of the nuclear laboratories, all of whom I had a chance to meet, tell me and the President and all of us that they have a deeper understanding of our arsenal from stockpile stewardship than they ever had when testing was commonplace. Let me repeat that. Our labs know more about our arsenal today than when they were able to explode weapons at our facilities on a regular basis. With our support, the labs can anticipate potential problems and reduce their impact on the arsenal. Unfortunately, during the last decade, our nuclear complex and experts were neglected and underfunded. Tight budgets forced more than 2,000 employees at Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore to lose their jobs between 2006 and 2008, including highly skilled scientists and engineers. And some of the facilities we use to handle uranium and plutonium date back to the days when the great powers were led by Harry Truman, Winston Churchill, and Joe Stalin. The signs of age and decay are becoming more apparent every day. And because we recognize these dangers, in December, Secretary Chu and I met at the White House with the heads of all three laboratories, weapons laboratories. They described the dangerous impact these budgetary pressures were having on their ability to manage our arsenal without testing. They say that the situation is literally a threat to our national security. And President Obama, Secretary Chu, and I all agreed. That's why earlier this month we announced a new budget that reverses the last decade of dangerous decline. It devotes $7 billion to maintaining our nuclear stockpile and modernizing our nuclear infrastructure. To put that in perspective, that's $624 million more than Congress approved last year and an increase of $5 billion over the next 5 years. Even in these tight fiscal times, we will commit the resources needed to require to maintain our security interests. This investment is not only consistent with a nonproliferation agenda, we argue it's essential to pursue a nonproliferation agenda. Guaranteeing our stockpile, coupled with broader research and development efforts, allows us to pursue deeper nuclear reductions without in any way compromising our security. As our conventional capabilities improve, we're going to continue to reduce our reliability on nuclear weapons. We'll be able to continue to reduce our reliability on nuclear weapons. Responsible disarmament requires versatile specialists who are able to manage the process. The skilled technicians who look after our arsenal today are the ones who will safely dismantle it tomorrow. And the chemists who understand how plutonium ages also develop forensic to track missing nuclear materials and to catch those who are trafficking in it. Our goal of a world without nuclear weapons has been endorsed by leading voices in both parties. Those include two former secretaries of state in Republican administrations, Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, President Clinton's Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry, and my friend and former colleague, Sam Nunn, for years the Democratic chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Together, these four statesmen call for eliminating nuclear weapons, and they called it a bold initiative consistent with America's moral heritage. During the 2008 presidential campaign, both President Obama and my friend John McCain, Senator McCain, supported the same objective. Folks, we're going to continue to build support for this emerging bipartisan consensus, like the one around the containment of Soviet expansion that George Kennan inspired. Toward that end, we've worked tirelessly to implement the President's Prague agenda. In September, the President chaired a historic meeting of the UN Security Council, which unanimously embraced the key elements that the President laid out in his vision in Prague. As I speak, U.S. and Russian negotiators are completing an agreement that will reduce strategic weapons to their lowest levels in decades. You know, its verification measures are going to provide confidence that that the terms of that agreement are going to be met. These reductions will be conducted transparently, and they will be predictable. A new START treaty will promote strategic stability and bolster the global effort to prevent proliferation by showing that the world's leading nuclear powers are committed to reducing their arsenal. And it will build momentum for the collaboration with Russia on strengthening the global consensus that nations who violate the NPT's obligations should be held accountable. This strategy is already yielding results. We have tightened sanctions on North Korea's proliferation activities through the most restrictive UN Security Council resolution to date, and the international community is enforcing those sanctions as we speak. And now we're working with our international partners to ensure that Iran also faces real consequences for failing to meet its obligations. In the meantime, we are completing a government-wide review of our nuclear posture. But already our budget proposals reflect some of the key priorities, including increased funding for our nuclear complex, a commitment to sustain our heavy bombers and land and sea-based missile capabilities under a new START agreement. As Congress requested, and with Secretary Gates' full support, this review has been a full interagency partnership. Another way of saying it to the average citizen out there, everybody's on the same page. Everybody's on the same page. We believe we've developed a broad and deep consensus on the importance of the President's agenda and the steps that have to be taken to achieve that agenda. The results will be presented to Congress and will be presented soon. And then in April, the President is also going to host a national security summit to advance his goals of securing all vulnerable nuclear material within 4 years. There's a lot of it out there. It's a very high priority. We cannot wait. We cannot wait for an act of nuclear terrorism before coming together to share the best practices and raise security standards. And we will seek firm commitments from our partners to do just that in April. In May, we will participate in the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. We are rallying support for stronger measures to strengthen inspection and to punish cheaters. You know, the treaty had a basic bargain. The basic bargain was that nuclear powers will pursue disarmament and non-nuclear states will not acquire such weapons while gaining access to civilian nuclear technology. That's the cornerstone and has been the cornerstone of the non-proliferation regime. Before the treaty was negotiated, and that's back in the early 60s, President Kennedy predicted that the world would end up with up to 20 nuclear powers by the mid-70s. But because of the non-proliferation treaty and the consensus it embodied, that didn't happen. Now, 40 years later, that consensus that constrained that kind of development and spread, that consensus is fraying. And it's time for us to reinforce this consensus and to strengthen the treaty for the future. And while we do that, we're also going to continue our efforts to negotiate a ban on the production of fissile material that can be used in nuclear weapons. We know that completing that treaty will ban the production of fissile material will not be easy to do, nor will it come quickly. But the Conference on Disarmament must resume its work on this treaty as soon as possible. The last piece of the President's agenda from Prague was the ratification of a comprehensive test ban treaty. A decade ago, we led this effort to negotiate this treaty in order, and people forget why we did it. It was designed, the treaty was designed in order to keep emerging nuclear states from perfecting their arsenal and preventing our rivals from pursuing ever more advanced weapons, as well as those who were not nuclear states from being able to even get there. We're confident, we're absolutely confident, and we've undertaken reviews to make sure our instincts are absolutely right. But we are confident that all reasonable concerns raised about the treaty back then, concerns about verification and the reliability of our own arsenal, have now been addressed. The test ban treaty is as important as ever. As President Obama said in Prague, and I quote, "We cannot succeed in this endeavor alone," the endeavor meaning the reduction of and eventual elimination of nuclear weapons. But he went on to say, "We can lead it and we can start it." That's what we're doing. Some of my friends in both parties have many questions about the various aspects of our approach that I've just laid out for you. Some of my own party may have trouble reconciling an investment of $7 billion in our nuclear complex with a commitment to arms reductions. Some of the other party may worry we're relinquishing capabilities that have kept our country safe. With both these groups, we respectfully disagree. As both the only nation to have ever used a nuclear weapon and as a strong proponent of nonproliferation, the United States has long embodied a stark but inevitable contradiction. The horror of nuclear conflict may make its occurrence unlikely, but its very existence, the very existence of nuclear weapons, leaves the human race ever at the brink of self-destruction, particularly if the weapons fall into the wrong hands. Many leading figures of the nuclear age grew ambivalent about aspects of this nuclear order. Kennan, whose writings gave birth to the theory of nuclear deterrence, argued passionately, but with futility, against the development of the hydrogen bomb. And Robert Oppenheimer famously lamented, after watching the first mushroom cloud erupt from a device he helped design, that he had become, quote, "the destroyer of worlds." Well, folks, President Obama is determined, I'm determined, Secretary Gates is determined, General Cartwright is determined, our entire government is determined that the destroyed world Oppenheimer feared must never become and will not become a reality. That's why we are pursuing the peace and security of the world without nuclear weapons. The awesome force at our disposal must always be balanced by the weight of our shared responsibility. Every day, many of you in this room, many of you in this audience, help bear that burden with professionalism, courage, and grace. A grateful nation appreciates your service. But together, we have to demonstrate to the world that we're going to live up to our responsibilities. Together, we will lead this world toward a world of less reliance and ultimately no reliance on nuclear weapons. I thank you for all that you do for the country. I thank you for taking the time to listen. And may God bless America, and may God protect our troops. Thank you very, very much.